People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the show, growing up with loved ones experiencing mental illness and sharing experiences as a suicide attempt survivor. We're revisiting some standout conversations from the fall. In September, I spoke with a trio of sisters in Spain. Here is the beginning of that segment.
He was the best father a daughter could have. Even with this hard situation, I think that he was a fighter.
A person is much more than his or her disease.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. You just heard Constanza, Beatriz, and Patricia Moran. They were speaking about their father, who died last year. He was an industrial engineer. Constanza says he made a tasty potato cake. He also developed schizophrenia when the three sisters were children. Today on the show, they'll share their story. Constanza has a PhD in biomedicine and works at a lab that researches schizophrenia in Barcelona. That's where I reached her and her sisters.
My name is Patricia Moran, but you can say Patricia if it is easier for you. And I am the eldest of the three sisters. I am a journalist focused on health, but lately I'm more interested in mental health. It is due to my father's disease. I have the honor to be the daughter of a person who had schizophrenia.
I'm Constanza Moran, and I'm a doctor in biomedicine, and I am working in a research group as a coordinator of a laboratory in schizophrenia research. And I am the youngest sister of Patricia, so I also had the honor of being the daughter of my dad, who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia.
My name is Beatriz Moran. I am the second of the three sisters, the three daughters of my father. I am veterinarian and I am working in a cats and dogs clinic.
Well, thank you all very much. I'm so glad we could all get together. We're going to chat today about family, about schizophrenia. Maybe the place to start, what are the first things you'd like people to know about your father?
I would say that my father was a wonderful and incredible father, but he had the bad luck to develop this disease, this disorder, this terrible disorder that is schizophrenia. He was my first love, I could say was my father, and it was terrible when he started to have this disease. I remember him in my childhood when we went to the beach playing with me. He was a normal father until then. I always like to say that my father didn't choose this disease. The disease chose my father. So it's very important to have in mind that no one wants to have this terrible disease.
I agree with my sister. My father, when I was a child, he was a fantastic father. I remember him. He was so protector and he enjoyed playing with us. But when I was 9 years and he fell ill, it was so much more complicated during the long period that he refused to be treated for the schizophrenia. But even with this hard situation, I think that he was a fighter because he could have something very, very difficult with this disease. He could keep with his daughters, his brother, sisters. He had a good job during all his life. He had autonomy. He had a house. So I think that he was very clever and he was a fighter person, because there are many people with schizophrenia that they lost jobs, their job, their families, and sometimes even they don't have a house, and they at the end they are living on the street in grave cases.
In my case, I must say that I also feel that he was the best father a daughter could have. And I'd like to say my father worked as an industrial engineer in the civil service in Spain. And
made a very good and tasty potato cake. I always remember that. And I also remember that he held my hand every day as he walked me to school, taught me and my two sisters to ride bicycles and also to drive a car in our hometown of Tarragona. And my father, who died in 2023 at the age of 79, also lived with paranoid schizophrenia, but this was one facet of his person. And despite the difficulties, the complexities, and the troubles that sometimes we went through as daughters, due to his disease, of course, I would choose him again. And I think that my sisters also agree on that.
Of course.
Yes.
As part of this program, I will make sure to include maybe the sort of official clinical information about what schizophrenia is to remind people. But would you be able to share in your experience what you would want people to know about the condition?
Schizophrenia is a very, very complex heterogeneous disorder, mental disorder. So it affects the behavior of the person that is affected, and it presents three types of symptoms. The positive symptoms, which are the hallucinations and the psychiatric conditions in that sense. The negative symptoms, which are the apathy, the social withdrawal, the isolation, the depression, and also the cognitive symptoms. So in the end, they have a lower memory sometimes, or they feel that they don't could execute certain tasks properly. So almost all the patients, or at least it's very frequent, that they don't really know about their disease. They are not conscious of their disorder. So they are not really aware that they are having this condition. So this means that probably the patients are not seeking for help, because this is called agnosognosia. So they are not aware of their illness, and this makes difficult to help them sometimes. In the end, we are also here to reivindicate that schizophrenia is a legitimate pathology, is a legitimate disorder, because sometimes society is not really prepared and not always embrace this disorder as we do with another kind of illnesses.
Could you tell me how schizophrenia, what it was like in your sort of day-to-day lives? How did it manifest itself?
As the eldest of the sisters, I remember clearly the moment. I was 13 when my father was admitted to a psychiatric hospital. It was the first time that the disorder appeared, and it was very sad for me because my superman, my super father, disappeared. And instead of my super father, then I had a new father, a sick father, what society says, a crazy man, a mad person. You know, this is very difficult for a child of 13 years old. It was very difficult, very hard for me to deal with this new situation. I remembered also that when I went back to school, because we were some days out of the school due to this difficult situation in my family. And when I went back, a girl asked me, "Why was your father at the hospital? Why didn't you come to the school?" It was terrible, a shock for me, this question. I said, "I rather say nothing. I rather say nothing." And it was the first time I felt the stigma, the auto stigma, because society is not prepared, as my sister says, for this kind of disorders. And this is very difficult for a child to deal with this kind of feelings. You have one father, and the day after you have another father.
Yes, in my case, I was only 9 years old, so when my father got ill. So I don't have this, I cannot remember clearly, but I can remember that my mother, at the end, she got divorced from him. And it was, we need to spend some days with him, with my father. And he was, when he wasn't in treatment, and it was very hard for me because sometimes he did dangerous things, for example, driving the car or shouting to other people on the street. It was very hard. In my life, I always hide. I always was hiding what my father was. I was ashamed. And this marks a child. But well, later it got different. The fear disappeared. I wasn't scared of him. But the relationship, it was difficult when he wasn't in treatment.
And in my case, my father was always ill. For me, the disease was always there. So all my memories are this way. And for me, it was normal to walk next to a father who sometimes shouted at people or covered one ear to avoid hearing other people's conversations. But I realized that for the other people, this did not seem normal. And sometimes I was scared, or other times I felt embarrassed. But at the end of the time, on my 30s, my 40s, I have really changed those feelings for the feeling of pride of walking next to my father. So now I'm in peace and I am proud of my father, maybe.
And I understand that he has also influenced maybe your career path and what you're doing professionally. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, well, in my case, I am a journalist. I am, as I said before, specialized in health. I didn't choose this path, but life gave it to me. And now that he died, I'm really interested to work again, mainly in mental topics. This is one thing. Another thing is that during my career, when I had to do an interview to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, I was really listening what they were telling me because I wanted really to write very good news to explain people the topic that we were talking about. I really tried to write my news with love, choosing each word carefully. And this is very difficult to do if you are not next to the disease, next to the people who has this disease. This was one thing. Another thing that is very important for me is that mostly in the newspapers, TV, radio programs, whatever, when journalists talk about schizophrenia, well, they don't talk. That's one point. They talk about another kind of disease like depression, suicide, which is the last thing that we have to talk about. Suicide is the consequence of schizophrenia and other mental disorders. But before suicide, we have to talk about other diseases. Quite often, they talk about depression, eating disorders, bullying, burnout, but schizophrenia is not there. So we have to put the schizophrenia in the media. That's another thing. And we have to talk in a positive way about it, not only in a bad way. For example, it is not necessary to say when in the news they are talking about a killer and he had a psychiatric history. Why? Is this useful? No. It increases the stigma of the person and the people around the person. I think that it's uncomfortable to talk about schizophrenia. It's a very long word to put in the headlines, but we have to find a way. So these are my thinkings about this. I want to talk of schizophrenia because schizophrenia is not in the media.
In my case, I never felt that my father's condition my career, my professional career, but I realized it did when in 2020 I saw this offer and they were seeking for a coordinator in a lab, in a research lab that they were actually investigating monographically schizophrenia. And then this offer came to me like I needed to get on that train. So it was like the path was really for me, was designed for me. And I was clear that I needed to change my research group. And I came directly to see what will happen here. And I'm really happy here. I feel I can help for increasing this the research in this disease that is really kind of abandoned when talking about investment. And I can help in this for my father, for my family, but for so many other families who suffer. And now that my father is no longer physically here, I see that we can, the three of us, we can dedicate all the efforts, all the energy that we used to dedicate him to care him. Now we can dedicate that energy to other people who maybe they are suffering alone or in silence as we did, because we didn't have extra time or extra energy to deal with other things that was not really my father. But now we have, and we can maybe accompany those people that are like we were before, now that we are okay, at least in terms of taking care of my dad.
Yes, well, in my case, I am veterinarian, and so I have not seen a direct influence of my father's condition in my work. But now, these days, we are enjoying a lot with, for example, your interview to help maybe and probably another people to speak about this.
Patricia, Beatriz, and Constanza Moren speaking about their father and schizophrenia. There was much more to that conversation. You can find the full version online and on our podcast feed. You should be able to find it using the search terms People First Radio, Three Sisters.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
We're going to stay on the subject of family, hearing part of a segment that was first broadcast this October. Nancy and Susan Grundy are the subject of Mad Sisters, a memoir written by Susan which chronicles the siblings' relationship from the 1960s through to the COVID-19 pandemic. When Nancy was 13, she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, a diagnosis that has since been updated to schizoaffective bipolar disorder. Over the decades that followed that initial diagnosis, Nancy would complete an arts diploma at Montreal's Concordia University and take courses in a Master's of Art Education program at McGill. She would also spend 13 years in a locked ward in a Montreal psychiatric hospital. Around that time, Nancy and Susan's parents moved overseas to Europe, and in the decades that followed, the siblings' relationship continued to evolve, as Susan was the main point person interacting with systems of care and advocating for her sister, even as they often clashed when they spent time together. Susan Grundy joined me to share more.
My name is Susan Grundy, and I live in Montreal, and I live in the Eastern Townships in Quebec, and I also live in London, UK. I have three homes, and I feel very fortunate for that. And I've written a couple of books. Mad Sisters is my second book. And I'm really happy to be here to talk to Joe about it today.
Yeah, that's the one we're going to talk about today. Mad Sisters, about your relationship with your sister, Nancy. How would you sum that relationship up for people?
Are you talking now or last week or last month? It's changed dramatically over the years. And very short answer, when we were kids, it was very cold and distant. We were very different. She was the good child. I was the naughty child. When she fell ill at 13, we had no relationship because she was absent. She was in the hospital and she returned a zombie sister, very medicated. as her medication wore off, or it didn't wear off actually, as she adjusted to the meds, and they probably increased, our roles reversed. So I became the good one and she was the bad, and we had an adversarial relationship. I all of a sudden could snitch on her. Yay. Then slowly our parents left the scene. They moved to Europe. In my 20s, I took on an advocacy role. She was in a hospital for 13 years in a locked ward. So I have to say there was a buffer of the hospital, but I slowly took on more responsibility, became her advocate. Couple more decades and she's out of the hospital and I am in charge of her living situation, full throttle caregiver. And that led to a power struggle between us, which, you know, because it's disempowering for her, despite my good intentions. And I would say, wow, that was a very antagonistic relationship. But good news is there's been some resolution. And wow, we have this loving, caring relationship now that's probably better than before she fell ill at 13.
And I would imagine that's kind of what you would need to have happen to write such a maybe revealing and very public memoir that goes into the details of decades of your relationship. And it's one that doesn't seem that it is often very pleasant, as it's relayed in the book. You two are constantly like fighting a lot with each other. How did you maybe get to a place where this is something that you decided I want to share with the world?
Well, first of all, the resolution didn't come while I was writing the book. It arrived as a result of, you know, a cathartic experience. So that it really helped. Nothing like putting something to paper to see. So I was angry when I first started writing the book, therefore the title. I'm a lot mad, actually. But, you know, as I got into it very quickly, I started realizing the need to share this with other people with similar experiences, with a loved one who struggles with mental health. But then that morphed as well towards the end, realizing that things weren't so great out there, the state of affairs of healthcare, and what my sister continues to experience. So I realize I've become more and more of an advocate myself for this whole situation with mental health or mental illness.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like even within the book, even when you were, say, still a young person, still in school going through this, there was this dynamic of, you know, when you're with your sister, you might squabble or you might fight. But, you know, if someone says something kind of ignorant on the school bus, you're going to get fired up and stand up for her. Can you tell me maybe about that dynamic?
Oh, I never forget those two girls. How old would I have been? I was in high school, but barely. So I was probably about 13. My sister would have been 16. And these two girls were on the bus and they didn't know me because I'm 3 years younger. I mean, just some twit. And they have these raccoon mascaraed eyes, you know, at that age. And they're going on about this crazy girl in their classroom. And Nancy had a bad time that day. She'd become catatonic during the class. And it was, I guess, dramatic. But I realized that they were talking about my sister and they were using words like, oh, she's so retarded. And I just like stood up all whatever 4 feet of me then. And I remember my heart was pounding because they looked at me like, who is this little kid? And I got off the bus early. I just told them, you have no idea what you're talking about. And don't, you know, my sister is suffering. Where's your compassion? I remember that. I was surprised myself because it was the first time I defended her.
Another common theme from the years and years of this story is there were a lot of times when either just you yourself would be in a meeting about your sister's future or her health, or you would both be in a meeting in a doctor's office somewhere and people would sort of address you and talk like almost as if your sister wasn't even in the room per se, say about like, this is a tumor that she has. Can you tell me just about that idea and what you make of it?
Well, it's stigma, you know, alive and well in the medical profession. And, you know, I read somewhere, these are not my words, but that we all live in a mental health continuum, which is very true, you know, but unfortunately, stigma is still alive and very well. And the situation you mentioned, our father had colon cancer. So we went and got these colonoscopies because we were already in our 50s. And the doctor wanted to see Nancy after her scan. And we went in there thinking, I don't know, we weren't expecting it. And all of a sudden, this is a surgeon. And, you know, surgeons don't necessarily have the best bedside humor. But this one didn't. And he looked at me and he said, well, there's a problem. And Nancy and I broke down. What do you mean? And he says, and he looks straight at me and says, you know, you have a tumor. And not to be selfish, but of course, I really feel like it's my tumor. And I mean, is it better that it's hers and not mine? Well, not really. But I had to tell him. I said, you know, can you please talk to my sister? Because he continued to speak only to me. And this has happened before, actually, in other situations where I've noticed that the doctors, when I'm in the room, they speak to me. My sister's very aware of it. You know, now she'll say something. I think that day she was too stunned to say anything, but yeah.
Another thing that really stood out reading through the story was that because this is something that chronicles decades and decades and decades, there are so many different situations, time periods. For example, it starts out and your sister is going to secondary school, I guess, in Quebec, which starts in grade 7. And you mentioned earlier on that there's a period of 13 years where your sister was really institutionalized. There are also periods where she's living in maybe sort of group homes and then independently in her own apartment. Could you walk me through maybe a bit of that journey, how it evolved and what some of the takeaways are from being there through that, through all of the various decades?
That's a very big question. Well, at the beginning, 1967, boy, I don't think anyone knew what schizophrenia was. And I'm talking, well, I guess the medical circle did, but when my sister was first ill, I just remember the adults around me were so curious. And it wasn't a thing. It really wasn't talked about. And in high school, there was no one else there that seemed at all slightly different from the norm. My sister stood out like a sore thumb. So there's that. Also, that time in the late 60s, and I'm sure this went on into the 70s, the type of treatment she received. I mean, at 13, she went into the Allen Memorial here. I think she was the only adolescent on the ward. So just that kind of, you know, you think there would be some special treatment, but she describes that time being thrust in a room for group therapy, surrounded by these older men. And she was very bright. She's 13 years old, a very pretty, very feminine young girl who's completely, you know, her world had been rocked, and she's dealing with, you know, she thinks some sexual innuendos from these other patients. Like, how did this ever happen that she didn't get more buffered? And I just have to say that I guess she's lucky, because she entered in at the Allen just before, I'm not sure how many years, like less than a decade before there was a big scandal here in Montreal. The Allen Memorial Hospital was sued by patients, psychiatric patients, because there'd been a grant accepted, this is a crazy story, by the CIA in the States to do experiments. They were looking at experimenting for brainwashing. So there were experiments involving LSD and shock therapy on psychiatric patients. It's huge. I know. I'm surprised they haven't made a film about it. Maybe they have. But this happened just before my sister went in. That would never happen now, I would think. And the hospital, by the way, was let off. There was a settlement of $100,000 per patient. So there's that. I'm staying in that era a lot because it's kind of shocking. Like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, shocking. And actually, Hollywood did help with the films, right? That there were more and more films about Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman. And I think that helped promote mental illness as a topic that we could talk about slowly. But over the years, I have to tell you, if you skip up to today and Nancy's most recent experience in a psychiatric ward, it seems very arcane. Like, I was shocked at the state of affairs in the psychiatric hospital last January here in Montreal. Not the Allen. I'm talking about another hospital. And the conditions, how I really was very difficult to be able to visit her there were so many restrictions. And so we have a long way to come, but good news. And I'm sorry if I'm skipping to another question, because I think this is important. There is a movement afoot, a global movement that's calling for a paradigm shift in psychiatric care, because we've been relying, the field has been relying mostly on medication since the 80s, you know, claiming a chemical imbalance. And I mean, I could go on and on about that and what's coming up with that as solutions, but we're talking about humanizing mental illness, more or less. Did I answer your question, Joe?
I don't know. I think one of the reasons the journey part is so fascinating to me is because not only does it is it a journey through time, it's also a journey through different places, and there's a lot of intersection. For example, you talked about in the 60s and the 70s what some of these institutions were like, and then very recently what they were like, and you were mentioning that you were still sort of shocked. Would you be able to go into more detail about maybe on that institutional level as a family member, maybe what kinds of things have changed that you've been able to observe in maybe a positive or negative way, and what things you feel like you haven't?
Okay, well, there's one good example. And I have to say, you know, I mean, I look at these doctors and these nurses and my heart goes out to them, because they're working with such budgets that have been cut, and right, and they're so stressed and burnt out. And he's a young psychiatrist that was seeing my sister this past January at the Douglas Hospital. And once I finally was able to speak to a psychiatrist, once she was on a ward, when she was in emergency for 10 days, I had really no access to doctors, which was too bad, because I had information about her medication. There were certain things that were really super important that I knew, because family members are invisible healthcare partners, but I couldn't get through. Once she was on the ward, the doctor immediately called a meeting and he said, okay, good. I need to know him. You know, he sat me down. So that was encouraging. He was shocked. What he said, you know, I read in her file that she was in a locked ward for 13 years in the 80s. He said, a typo, right? And I went, no. So, I guess the good news is that he was shocked that she was there for that long, because that's not happening anymore at that age. And I'm not talking about people who get older, but that is rare. That was good news. But I just noticed in her care, especially even when she was on a ward, a little detail, but it's very important to have a family member, you know, the support of a family member when you're hospitalized, presuming it's a positive relationship. And there were so many restrictions about visiting her. I had to call ahead of time and book a room. If someone else had booked the room, I was out that day, because there was a window of, I don't know, between 2 and 4 in the afternoon. So often I would call and it was like, oh no, you can't see her until Friday. And we're talking Tuesday. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm bringing her supplies. I'm, you know, having a connection. She didn't have a phone anyway. So, wow. I mean, there's that kind of, and I have to tell you that the ICU was an absolute nightmare. I mean, it was really, for someone, it was not for the faint of heart.
In what sense? In a sort of siloing kind of sense?
Well, you know, okay, there's a security guard. That's fine. That's okay. They want to make sure you don't have anything sharp. Fine, they you know, they're basing this on past experiences. But I mean, he was a bit of a bully, and he made me like raise my arms like I'm hiding something. I mean, I'm like, and you can't, it was like I was at the airport. Okay, there's that. Then you walk through double doors, you know, two sets of steel doors. And I understand, because the ICU there can be people there who are they've lost it, and there's a lot of yelling and banging, and you know, one could be a little fearful, but I felt quite comfortable there because I've grown up with this. And thank God the person who was walking around banging the walls had not been put in the side room. So there's a bit of an evolution. When my sister was in that locked ward for 13 years, there was a side room, and this is the 1980s and into the early 90s. And in the side room, they put you in a restraining jacket, and you weren't allowed to let out to pee. You know, you were in there for hours. So, and I know my sister spent some time in that room, and I know that's really been very, it's had a very strong effect on her. that trauma has not left her. I'm sure it hasn't helped her, you know, deal with the situation. So it's just the conditions are not so okay. There still is a side room, but this fellow that day in January, last January, had not yet been put in it. I'm sure he was later on in that day, though. Sort of inevitable.
Another place some of these tensions maybe emerge between like the system and the family caregiver. There were a few times when, say, for example, you were called to these meetings and your sister had been living somewhere and there was a sort of unspoken, well, the spoken part was she can't stay here very much or any longer and you sort of have to figure something out.
You notice that happened a few times.
Can you tell me what being in that position is like?
Well, first of all, there is some, it in a way, it does fuel you with some anger because you're looking. I remember being in a room where there's the psychiatrist, the social worker, the nurse, the nutritionist, and they're all looking to me for the solution because they don't have one. And that's extremely frustrating, right? Because who am I? I mean, I'm her sister. And, you know, there's always this underlying pressure for me to take her into my home. And I've done that. And I know that that's not going to work. So, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a David and Goliath situation because, you know, I'm just this one person and I'm up against this whole public healthcare system that's not delivering. It's really maddening. And it's sad and it's very isolating. You know, you feel completely alone because you know, and who else there is to help me? In my particular situation, our parents were not involved. I'm the only sibling. You know, sure, I have children, but I hate downloading on them. I want them to be free of this kind of responsibility I've grown up with and that I've continued to carry. So yeah, you feel very much alone and you go out there in the public health system and you try to find help. And good luck. In Quebec, I'm not sure about BC, but they've decentralized healthcare services down to these clinics. I don't know what stands for, CLSC clinics. So I'm not dealing anymore with, let's say, the hospital or even the doctor. I'm dealing with the clinic. But I mean, the help there is very thin, especially for mental health care. So right now, I'm not really supported. You know, I've kind of accepted that I have to find my own resources. And I have to say, and I'm privileged because our father left us money to take care of my sister. So I can use that money and I'm not having to pay. So I've set her up in her own apartment because there was nowhere else for her to go. And thank God, because the millions of people who don't have those financial resources, they're the ones on the street. They're on the street.
Susan Grundy speaking with me in October. You can hear the full version of that conversation online. You should be able to find it using the search terms People First Radio, Susan Grundy.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Coming up on the show, we're going to hear a conversation from October in which Edmonton's Isaiah Neal shared his experiences as a suicide attempt survivor. Before our conversation, here's Neal speaking at a panel discussion at Toronto Metropolitan University in October of this year.
As it was said, I am a suicide attempt survivor, and I honestly wear that with a lot of pride, not because it's some sort of accomplishment, but when you deal with suicide and you're in that space of mind, you enter this dark abyss, and in this dark abyss, your will to live and hope dies. To give you a little bit of context, I come from 14 years of playing the game of football, and you quickly learn that the status quo is shove your emotions down and don't talk about it. When you get her on the field, you pick up your teeth and you run. it's quite like that, and it's like that in many other sports. You keep running and running and running until you literally cannot stop or continue running. And so when I was dealing with suicide, that was the first thing that I had to learn, was to open up and talk about it. And so to kind of go back to this dark, deep abyss, imagine, you know, going to this busy, unknown city and you don't have a GPS. It's not going to turn out too well, right? You're not going to be able to get anywhere that you need to go. And this GPS is like this will to live, this hope, because your will to live and your hope is your compass. It's your GPS to this busy, unknown city called life. And when I lost that compass, when I lost that GPS, I was lost. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to understand this. Even going to therapy for myself, it's like, what's the problem? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why I don't want to live. I don't know why I don't want to see tomorrow. And you get stuck. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to understand that. And if you ever, you know, if you would like to kind of expand your knowledge on that, I really strongly encourage listening to people that are suicide attempt survivors. There's a great book called One Friday in April. It's Someone's Suicide Experience by David Atrum. And it's well orchestrated. But, you know, the thing about the 21% of youth dying by suicide, there's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it and say, wow, that's a lot of youth that we've lost and will lose at this rate. Or you can say, wow, that's a lot of youth that have lost hope, that have lost a will to live. And the other, you know, flip side of this is like, you know, that's numbers, right? But when you actually put yourself in the shoes of a person that is dealing with suicide ideation, it takes a lot of courage and strength that is beyond measure or imagination to actually die by suicide. It's crazy. And for me, this statistic is like, wow, there's 21% of youth that will go down this path and go through these hard decisions and make that decision to end their lives. And for me, that's the scary thing. And for me now, it's like the question for all of us in this room is, why are young people losing hope? Right? We can look at it at a psychological level and a science level and look at the statistics, but at the end of the day, the question is, why are young people losing hope? And it's not a straightforward answer, right? But for all of us in this room, our responsibility is to be that light in that abyss and show them the way out.
Isaiah Neal, speaking as part of a panel on youth mental health in October at Toronto Metropolitan University. I had the chance to follow up with him ahead of this week's program. At a recent panel, you said the question is, why are young people losing hope? Could you tell me more maybe about that question and where it comes from?
Yeah, for sure. So suicide is a very hard topic to talk about. It's also very hard to understand, whether you're the one that's experiencing it or you're around other people that are experiencing it. But at the end of the day, it's really that loss of hope. It's that loss of will to live. And that is really the problem that we're having. There's many ways to look at suicide, but I think the easiest way to look at it is that loss of hope. And how do we return that hope to that person? And how do we restore that? And not only just restore that, how do we maintain it? Because sometimes it goes out and sometimes it comes back on. It's kind of flickers. So how do we maintain that hope and that will to live?
Could you maybe tell me about your process of finding that hope again and maintaining that hope?
Yeah, for sure. So I struggled a lot with suicide for the last about 3 years, in and out of depression. And then I usually get followed by not wanting to live. And so what I found was talking about it was the biggest thing, because for me, when I was dealing with suicidal ideation, I got trapped in this echo chamber of negative thoughts and negative thinking. And it required a person outside of my bubble to come and kind of break that cycle. But most oftentimes, you have to ask for that help. You have to ask for that third person. And that can be very difficult for you to do when you're inside this bubble. So for me, I was kind of just that leap of faith and that hope that I got nothing else to lose. I might as well try something. And I took a really drastic measure and revealed what I was going through and asked for help from pretty much everyone that was around me, whether it was my family. I was currently playing for the University of Alberta on the football team. So I was talking with coaches, with teammates, just reaching out and just talking about what I was going through. And when I realized that, hey, I'm stuck in this echo chamber of negative thoughts, I was able to see, hey, you know, there's more than what I'm seeing here, right? There's more to the issue. And when I started to have those conversations more and more, just made things a little bit easier each day. Of course, I had ups and downs, but again, just went back to, you know, making sure that you're talking to someone is the biggest thing.
You talked in the past about 14 years of playing football, and there can be this culture within some sports of, you use the phrase, you know, you get hurt on the field, you pick up your teeth and run. So what was it like when you were maybe talking to coaches and people involved in the sport about what you were going through?
Yeah, so it was definitely very difficult. And I think the very first coach that I reached out to had also shared his struggles with suicide during COVID, because during COVID, there was no season. And we had these little workshop sessions where we kind of shared and talked about our experiences. And so when I was going through my period of suicidal ideation at the time, I remember that coach. And I was like, hey, that's a great starting point. And so I started talking to him. Then there was another staff member on our team that does a lot of kind of psychological and motivational training. And I was like, well, that's another great person. So I talked to her, and slowly I kind of just built the strength, because both of those people were so receptive, and they were also encouraging me like, hey, don't be scared. This team is going to love you no matter what. And then that's when I built up the courage to kind of just let everyone know like, hey, sometimes I'm going to be struggling. Sometimes I'm going to be down, but, you know, bear with me and hold me up, and I'm going to be here for you guys 100% of the way.
So there was someone who had maybe shared their own story, their own experiences, and that helped it make it a lot easier for you to like open up in the first place to someone?
Exactly. And that's really the reason why I open up now, is because there's always going to be that one person that's looking like, who else is dealing with this? And a lot of times, you know, when I've shared my story, I find other people that are also struggling, and we have a conversation, and that's kind of like their first step into the right direction. So it's the reason why I am so open, because it was really the answer for me. And I'm hoping that I can help someone else out as well.
You also recommended, for people looking to maybe learn more about the topic, a book, One Friday in April. Can you tell me maybe a little bit about what you found that it did a good job at?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, from a person that has experienced suicide and suicidal ideation, as well as attempting suicide, this book really encapsulated a very special kind of feeling or a moment in time when you're going through something like this that is not in textbooks. It cannot be described by most people. It's something that people have trouble explaining. And it's this weird, I guess, on the fence feeling of letting go, but still wanting to hold on. And I think that's a really important thing when it comes to people that are struggling with suicide. It's not always that they want to die. It's a last resort option that they see no way out. And I believe that this book does an excellent job of encapsulating this feeling that, you know, I don't want to die, but I don't see any way out. And this is what I got to do. There is no other answer. So that's really what hit home for me, and I hope it hits home for anyone else reading it, because it is very difficult to understand when someone's opening up to you and saying that they don't want to live anymore.
Are there any things that you feel like maybe our systems of care could do a better job at making it easier to see a different pathway out of those situations?
That's a good question. I honestly don't have a straightforward answer for that, but I think it comes from listening to people with lived experience, because it's one thing to read about it or to hear about it in a textbook or an academic setting, or even from a clinician. It's different for everyone. My experience is not going to be the same as someone else's. And so it's extremely important that we listen to everyone's story to kind of paint this bigger picture and see where this can actually lead. And unfortunately, that's kind of the hard part, is why we don't have this bigger picture, because we don't have enough people that are open to it. And that goes a lot with stigma in our society, why people don't talk about it, but also the different demographics that don't speak about it. There's lots of different cultures that this is a very taboo subject, but a lot of those demographics are what we are seeing in the reports for mental health increase in declines, that these individuals and these demographics are not speaking up about it, which is why we have no idea on how to help them, because we're not hearing their story.
And I want to talk about the big new report, the national report on youth mental health. And of course, a few things you just said really relevant to this. The idea that mental health itself is such like an umbrella term and a continuum that every one person is going to have their own different experiences. But maybe some of the trends from there that stood out to me was there was this idea that young people are talking much more about mental health and mental health issues than other generations, but with two big caveats. That one, the report suggested there was still a lot of stigma for people to talk about their own experiences, what they were going through, and that two, even with young people talking more, the report suggested their mental health literacy was about the same as anyone else. I'm wondering if you could speak to maybe some of those ideas.
Yeah, for sure. So I definitely think there's kind of two main categories in terms of why people don't speak. Obviously, there's not only two categories, but the two big ones that I see are those that personally just don't want to disclose that because they see it as some type of weakness as well. It's very private, so that's totally okay. But then there's also that group that doesn't want to speak out because they don't feel like there is a space. And that's the real big category that is a problem for me, because how many more people want to speak out or want to ask for help, but they can't because they don't have a safe place. And that's really a responsibility for all of us to take on. Is, you know, you may not understand the whole scope of mental health, but we can all show kindness and respect for other people's experiences and whatnot when it comes to mental health. So I think that's something that is kind of very easy to do theoretically, but of course to change people's minds and perspectives is definitely very hard. When it comes to the report, when it's talking about the literacy, that is not as much of a big surprise to me. I think because we're so much on our phones, we're downloading and digesting what we see the most, which is what's on our phones. And I don't think the media has done a good job in terms of putting out safe language and literacy. I think that's still kind of kept behind the gates by academics and certain communities that have that access to that type of literacy. But I think that can be also improved as well with having these organizations that have the knowledge to be on these platforms and share knowledge, kind of like Jack.org does, again, just sharing those little tidbits of knowledge and messages as well as literacy that can go a long way when it comes to opening up and talking about mental health or suicide.
You use there two phrases, safe language and literacy. And I'm wondering if there, you feel there are any maybe especially important or easy to get across points that you think more people should know about that you could share?
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the biggest ones is the use of committed suicide. Rather, we should say died by suicide. Committed is an accomplishment. It's a tick off the to-do list. And suicide isn't like that. And it's not fair to do that to the victims. It's more respectful to say someone has died by suicide, to respect the fact that what they've gone through as well as the means and the nature that they have passed. So I think that's one of the biggest ones. I think in terms, maybe not so much literacy, but in terms of how we talk about mental health, not seeing mental health or mental illness as the person, but seeing it as something that they are facing or they're living with. For me, I dealt a lot with anxiety. I've had anxiety attacks over dozens of times, and I've fainted. I've had convulsions. I've gone numb in my toes and my hands. And for a long time, I really identified with anxiety. I believed that I had this problem. But when I changed the perspective that I was living with anxiety, maybe similar to when we say, hey, someone is living with cancer, it really separates the two, that we have this individual, we have this person, and we see them as the person that they are. But then there's something that they're facing, and that is the anxiety. But in no way, shape, or form is the anxiety who they are or their identity. So really separating those two allows the person to show up in a good way and to show up how they are as a person apart from that and not be labeled by that.
You also mentioned earlier that sort of everyone is on their phones. You shared that when you were in high school, you weren't really a social media user. Can you tell me about that experience of being born in the 21st century and not using social media?
Yeah, for sure. So I remember my very first phone was an LG Android, and it was one of those ones that you like slide and you have like a keyboard underneath the screen. And that was like my first interaction with a phone, I think at about the age of 12. And then I like found out that I wasn't cool and I had an Android and it slid, and I was like, no, I need an iPhone. So I got an iPhone. And, you know, just having a phone for me, it was kind of almost pointless. Like I never answered calls. I never answered text messages because I was just never on my phone, even for social media. Social media was kind of something that my parents, specifically my mom, kind of just shied me away from and said, don't get involved. And at the time, you know, I was the only child and I was very obedient and I didn't want to make her upset. So I just didn't go on it. And then, you know, going through all of junior high, I never had social media. So by the time I got to high school, it's like, why am I jumping on something just for the sake of it? I've always been a hard person on myself for not just joining something for the sake of it, just because everyone else is doing it. It was a personal decision. And when I look back at it, I really see all the benefits. So, you know, at the time, I wasn't like not on social media because I was like, oh, I don't want to, you know, mess up my head. No, I just personally made that decision. And in retrospect, in hindsight, I'm like, wow, that made a really big difference in my life. And, you know, I'm on social media now for sure. But just my relationship with it now and seeing how, you know, my peers were at my age when I didn't have social media and how it's changed them and affected them, you know, that's something that I see now. And I'm really thankful that I was able to kind of escape that in some way. So yeah, it's definitely been good not to have so much social media in my life at such an early age.
Isaiah Neal speaking with me in October. You can find the full version of that segment online using the search terms People First Radio, October 31st, 2024. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder, you can find the show online and as a podcast, just search People First Radio. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'll talk to you again next year.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.